Please help me welcome J. Lauren Norris.
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious, I am not Mary Poppins. But you know what else I'm not? I'm not enough of a master of words to know what in the world supercalifragilisticexpialidocious actually means. Is there a meaning to that word? Does it have a definition? I mean, the old joke is, it's the longest word in the English language. Can you spell it? Most people can't because they try to spell supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, and that takes a minute. But the real joke is, can you spell it? It. I-T. Two letters. See, plays on words, they can be incredible or dangerous. They can also reveal your attitude and your worldview and how you think about things and phrases that you might use in common conversation, and they might seep into a communication style format like a blog or a post or a live video or a presentation from stage or a sales conversation. Those words reveal a lot about you, and that's what I want to talk about in this episode of Leading Leaders with a focus on story power. Stay tuned. I'm J. Lauren Norris with Leading Leaders Podcast. It's amazing how often someone will use a word that, they chose it carefully. They really thought through it. It had a very specific meaning. I've got some books over here on my shelf that, one in particular that comes to mind from a friend by the name of Dr. Randy Weiss. He's got a couple of different PhDs and a couple of different things, but on the regular, in his books, he'll use words that the word itself is almost as long as supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Sometimes they have a hyphenated, I'm kidding, they're not quite that long, but they're close. You know, just to wrap on in the next line, they're not quite that long, but they're close. But if you look up the meaning of the word, which you kind of have to do because it takes up half of the paragraph, and the meaning of the word, if you just took the meaning of the word and tried to put it back into the context. I don't know if you've ever done that. You take a word out of a sentence and you put the definition of the word in the sentence and try to reread it. It explains a lot about the writer and their thinking. But some of these words Dr. Weiss uses they're so deeply nuanced that you can't really just shove them back in the paragraph because, well, the definition is a paragraph or two as well. And the definition may have multiple language applications where the etymology of the word, etymology, I can never get those two right. It really bugs me. The origin of the word, its origin actually could mean something entirely different in another language. And only by the implication of the context around it do you have an idea of which language it might be referring to, which origin it might be referring to. How do various people use that word? Now, the irony is, most people read and write, and I say most people, the average citizen around the globe, at about a 5th to 7th grade reading level. Which means if you use big, gigantic academic words, then either you already know who your audience is or you don't care that most people don't get it. It's funny when you talk to attorneys, they generally have a way of using big words because they've experienced the same thing. If I try to give you the whole definition of what it means to set precedence, we'll be here for a minute. Because even precedence, legal precedence, social precedence, cultural precedence, what do we mean by setting precedence? And the definition of the word itself has different meaning in different applications, just like it might in different languages. But an attorney is going to assume, if you're having a conversation with them, that the word precedence has a specific meaning. Unfortunately, for people who refuse to dig into the words, dig into the meaning of the words, that's not always the case. And it is often the case that, especially when I was in the Dale Carnegie program as a coach, I would encounter people in the engineering world as an example, or the medical pharmaceutical world as an example, where there was some industry-related colloquialisms or turns of phrase that in that industry, they mean a lot. You just kind of put it right there. When I was in Yellow Pages sales, yeah, we used to actually sell ads into a printed book that was about 2 inches thick. In Yellow Pages ad sales, there was that number. When you dial the number and it's no longer in service or it's OB, disconnected, we called it the national anthem of the broke. Because when you got that number, everybody knew you were already out of business. Everybody knew your number had been disconnected or is no longer in service. For an ad sales rep, that was a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it meant you're not responsible for returning the revenue that was out on that ad last year because, well, they're out of business and you can't get blood out of a tournament. On the other hand, it meant you had one less opportunity to sell. It's a double-edged sword. Which one do you like? But just the phrase, the national anthem of the broke, well, that could be applied to the business that went out of business because they're not making any money anymore. That's why they're out of business. Or it could apply to the ad sales rep because if you get too many of those, you got nothing to sell because you got nobody to sell to. You got too many bad numbers. But the application of the implication was almost always up to the attitude of the person who dialed the number. See, the colloquial phrases in the medical world, they have a specific meaning to them, but they also just using the phrase in that industry where people know the meaning of that word, well, it reveals a lot about your attitude, about how you look at customers. If you call a patient a victim of what? Are you talking about victims of abuse, of a car accident, of a stabbing, of a robbery, of a drive-by? What victims are you talking about? Now, if all of a sudden you say victims of Dr. So-and-so, oh, now that's a whole different thing. In fact, that statement might have legal ramifications that could get you in major trouble because that would be considered slander. See, the term victim has a very specific application to it. There was a teaching that came out by a guy by the name of Vodi Bakum. It's been about 3, maybe 4 years ago. He quoted from Princess Bride, "I don't think that word means what you think it means, and yet you just keep using it." That's a pretty powerful observation. Now, here's my own observation. There are a lot of people who consider themselves communicators, who are not real diligent about the words that they choose. The words that they choose may be mispronounced, misapplied, misappropriated. And because those words can often be inserted into a story that makes you sound significantly more intellectual than perhaps you really are, or makes you sound superior to the audience you're speaking to, but it seems apropos for the moment, use of those big giant words might articulate an attitude that you have toward the people you're speaking to, that they're just not quite as good as you. And that might be not your intent, simply the way it's received. Generally speaking, I'm fairly diligent. I'd put myself on a scale of about a 6 and a 1 to 10 of the kind of guy who always looks up the words before I use them. 6 out of 10. I would also say that if I hear someone say a word, especially if it's in a video and I can hit the pause button, they say a word that I'm not clear on, I'm going to pause them and I'm going to go look it up so that I make sure that I understand what they're saying. It's not uncommon, though, whether it's in conversation or it's in coaching or it's from the platform, that I watch the look on people's faces when I use a word and I can see a few different expressions. The most common 3 responses to a word that you don't understand the meaning of is, hang on, can you explain that? Can you back up a little? I want to hear the word again, and I want to hear how you're using it, not just in the context of what you're saying, but I want to make sure that we have a common understanding of the meaning of that word. Even if we don't agree on it, at least I know what you intend to mean by that statement. Not everybody's going to give you the luxury of being able to hit the pause button and ask them to contextualize the meaning of a word that you're using. I was listening to a debate this morning. 3 women, 1 gentleman, discussing feminism. Three different women on the panel had three different definitions of feminism. That makes it really hard to argue, to debate, to discuss. An orange, if you don't know what an orange is. If you're looking at a tomato that's half ripe, it might have the color orange, but its guts are completely different. Is it orange? Yes. Is it an orange? No. Specificity is a big deal. See, the thing that I find in storytellers, especially those who feel like, well, I'm good, I just talk off the cuff, is that they're not real intentional about the words that they choose. Sometimes they use those words and they don't mean what everybody else in the audience would take them to mean. And maybe they've heard them out of context all of their life and thought something else about it. Maybe they were living it instead of livid. Yeah, you'll have to go back two or three episodes to hear that whole discussion. The second way that people react is that they just kind of wait to see if the word you used that they're not familiar with can be picked out of the context. If the rest of what you say puts something around that word that gives you an idea what the word might mean, if you're not familiar and not bold enough to push the pause button and go, hold on, can you help me understand what you mean by that? I was in a conversation recently with a guy who had quite the presentation, a great idea on making money, how to raise funds, and had some comparatives to other people who are doing similar things. And I listened very intently to everything that was said and all of the presentation. Then I asked a couple of very pointed questions. And the reaction that I got was as if to say, I haven't had anybody else ask that question when making this presentation. Which kind of takes me back to my high school days. It's pretty common that the teacher would teach something and I would be the only student with my hand up and the rest of the class is going, oh my gosh, not him again with the questions. We all get it. And I'm like, you don't get it. I can tell by your answers that you don't get it. You're following the process, but you don't understand what you're doing. You might even come to the right eventual answer, but you don't understand why you're getting that answer. I want to know why. I want to understand the whole process. I want to understand the steps and how do we get here from there? I also got in trouble on a regular basis because I would find other ways to get the same answer pretty consistently, but it wasn't the method being taught, and that didn't go over well with my teachers, as you can imagine. See, all of this goes back to the same thing of, do you understand the same thing that's being said? Or as Chris Tucker, do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth? To which Jackie Chan replied, I am Chinese, not deaf. Yelling it doesn't make it any more clear if the words you're using are unintelligible, if the language you're using is undefined, if the words that you're choosing don't have the common meaning that you think they do, or they don't mean what you try to mean with them at all. Maybe you think we live in a democracy. We don't. It's not our form of government. Never has been. In fact, our founding fathers hated the concept of a democracy. One of them was quoted as saying, democracies live violently. They're born violently. They die violently. That was not their intent. In fact, another founding father was asked, what kind of nation have you given us? To which his reply was, a republic, if you can keep it. We don't live in a democracy. And yet, repeatedly, we hear things like, that's so dangerous for our democracy. Well, it would be great if we had one, but we don't have one. Now, are we arguing about semantics? Or does that distinction matter? Is it a distinction without a difference, or a difference without a distinction? Or do we distinctly differ in our opinions of that word? Well, it's a pretty big difference. It's like the definition of diagnosis versus prescription. Two totally different things. Democracy and a republic, two totally different things. Faith and religion, two totally different things. And if you're flippant about the way you use these words, then that flippancy can cause someone else to kind of fall into the casualness of the meaning of what you're trying to convey. And if the stories that you tell are not specific to the meanings of your words, then you might find people in that vague state of saying, I'm just listening to what you're saying in the context of everything else that you're saying, and your use of big words may or may not impress me, but it doesn't necessarily change my opinion because I'm just listening to the context. And that one big word is like a, I don't know, it's a wart on a princess's nose. It really stands out, but it doesn't belong there. It's pretty obvious. Now, the third way that people react to words that you choose that they don't understand, they don't know the meaning of, perhaps it's out of their regular vocabulary or not in their dialogue or dialect, or maybe you're mispronouncing it, misapplying it all together, and they're thinking like a dog listening to a weird sound. That doesn't belong there. It doesn't fit there. It's kind of like the wart on the princess's nose. But their reaction isn't to try to pause or contextualize, or give the good grace of saying, well, I don't know what the word means, but I assume you used it right. But instead, they have an emotional reaction to the word you chose. Now, that can be problematic really, really fast. In fact, that's how people get triggered. There's a whole series of videos on various social media platforms of an individual who is very masculine, facial hair, giant shoulders, big square jaw, deeper voice than mine, who likes to go into restaurants and film themselves being engaged by servers. And when the server says, yes, sir, no, sir, this individual throws a fit, films the whole thing, calls for a manager, asks to go over the manager's head. I can't believe so-and-so misgendered me. This is their entire social media platform is built on the idea that someone called that person a him when that person would rather be called her or they. It's all about pronouns. Now, whatever you think of the social impact of the decision to change your pronouns from what they might have been when you were 2 or 3 years old, or what they might have been when the doctor handed you over to your mother, to use different pronouns than the doctor might have used in that moment 20 years ago, 40 years ago, it's totally up to you. To ask everyone else to agree with you, well, that's a step in another direction. How you choose to refer to you, totally up to you. How you expect everyone else to refer to you, well, that requires agreement. Not compelling, but agreement. I can't make you believe what I believe. I mean, if I came to you with my Christian faith and said, you must, blah, 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 you might think I was a nut. In fact, you might even file lawsuits against me for forcing my religion on you, like asking people to pray in a public school, or say a Pledge of Allegiance in a public school. In fact, there have been lawsuits against that to say, we don't want that because we don't want to make our kids believe like you believe. And yet, this individual is thoroughly convinced that there should be some legal action against you because they want to be called they or her or zer or something other than him. Drastic difference. But here's the real point. The word choices that you use as a storyteller, as a communicator, those word choices can be as volatile as him or her, as them or zer, or they, as faith or religion or God, as Democrat, Republican, liberal, or MAGA. Those words can be unintentionally seeded into the conversation as distinctions which drive emotional responses you weren't planned for. It wasn't your intent to push people off the edge emotionally. It wasn't your intent to rise up their ire. It wasn't your intent to draw from them an evoked emotional response of anger, bitterness, and vitriol, or to bring them to tears. It wasn't my intent to hurt your feelings. It wasn't my intent to make you angry with me or to alienate you. Really, what that says is you weren't intentional about your word choice. There was a particular time that, and I've told this story before, but I want to put it in the context of this specific teaching. A guy followed me around for a while. We would run into each other in various places, and he would always ask me, as a speech coach, what was your opinion of my presentation? Or what would you, you know, how can I get you to come and hear me talk? I'd like to know what you think of it. And I always told him, there's a fee for that. It's on the website. You can sign up and pay for that and tell me what date to be there, and I will be there at your engagement. I will give you a full audit of what you do. I charge for that. It's not free. But I will be glad to do that and give you a full, honest, objective assessment of what you had to say. And I can do that from whatever level, just the way you present it, from the words that you said, from the theological truth and accuracy behind it, to the sociological impact that it's going to have, whether it's the political or the socioeconomic or even the social cultural impact that it's going to have. Where's the message going to go? What is the overall narrative? Where does it fit in the stratosphere of communications? I can evaluate all those things. And by the way, I have been studying leadership for over 30 years, so I can add a little bit of that to it as well. And I do have 10 years worth of marketing background, so I can add all that. I can put all these layers into an audit and give you as much of a full analysis of what you have to say as you would like. It's not free, but I'm glad to do it. He never wanted that. He just wanted an opinion. And on many occasions, he would ask, what do you think? Yep, you spoke. That's my opinion. You spoke. One particular case, he caught me. We were at an event. He was the presenter. I was there because I was asked to present the following week. And so I was there as a guest of the area vice president. The area vice president and I sat together. I sat at his table when the event was over. We were standing out in the hallway chatting. And this speaker came to me and he said, well, finally, you got to hear a full presentation. What do you think? And with the five or six people that were standing around, I said, well, are you asking for an audit or are you asking for an opinion? He said, coming from you, I would be glad just to get an opinion. I said, my opinion is that was the most pedantic speech I've heard in a long time. He said, I'll take that as a great compliment coming from you. Thank you. Gave me a high five and walked off. Now, if you right now are thinking, well, that is a pretty high compliment, that's only because you don't understand the word pedantic. And I'll challenge you right now to go look it up. Pedantic. P-E-D-A-N-T-I-C. Pedantic. And then ask yourself, who uses a word like pedantic? And was it a compliment or not? And if you're so bold as to do the homework, this is your pause button. Hit pause right now, look up the word pedantic, and then put it in the comments whether you think that was a compliment or not. Word choice. If you talk about 2A, or you talk about MAGA, or you talk about WEF, you talk about the jab. People might determine your worldview very quickly. If you talk about the president, election cycles, border crossings, illegal immigrants or unusual migrants, your word choice will reveal your attitude and your worldview faster than anything else. In fact, you could write an entire presentation, every story lined up to point to a certain ideology that you portray, and by word choice alone, betray yourself. I'm challenging you as communicators, don't just choose better stories to tell, but tell better stories better. Tell them better by having intentionality, by choosing your words cautiously, by knowing the meaning of those words, not just in your own thoughts, your own heart, your own mind, your own opinion, but what do they mean contextually in the universe? If I said to a 20-year-old, I don't know, dude's kind of sus. Really, bro? My mother would look at me and go, why don't you speak in complete sentences? And my 20-year-old son would go, dude, really? Because he knows exactly what I just said. And that's not Ebonics. That's not another language. That's not a foreign language. It's the way many Gen Z and millennials have chosen to communicate. And it's reinforced in their gaming and their social media. And you can either be on board with that form of communication, or you can continue to speak to all of them as though they have a master's degree in literary sciences. It's entirely up to you. But I would encourage you as a leader and a communicator to tell better stories better, choosing words that fit the audience that you're talking to. I'm J. Lauren Norris with Leading Leaders Podcast for Tell It Like It Is TV. Have a blessed day.
Lauren is a master teacher on storytelling, and I learned so much. I'm really going to have to sit down and go back through everything, and I think I might have to have some more coffees with Lauren, but it was totally worth my time, and I really highly recommend it if you're looking to grow your ministry, grow your business, grow your career. Lauren will serve you well.
Thank you.
Subscribe now for our extensive video library of leadership lessons promoting faith, family, and freedom.